Chapter 27. Miss Saurian, who has been honored here tonight, for I see at this very table here is a Miss Saurian indicating Mr. McElway, and there is a Miss Saurian indicating Mr. Depew, and there is another Miss Saurian and Hendricks and Clemens. And last but not least, the greatest Miss Saurian of them all, here he sits, Tom Reed, who has always concealed his birth till now. And since I have been away, I know what has been happening in his case. He has deserted politics, and now is leading a creditable life. He has reformed, and God prosper him. And I judge, by a remark which he made upstairs a while ago, that he hath found a new business that is utterly suited to his make and constitution, and all he is doing now is that he is around raising the average of personal beauty. But I am grateful to the President for the kind words which he has said of me, and it is not for me to say whether these praises were deserved or not. I prefer to accept them just as they stand, without concerning myself with the statistics upon which they have been built, but only with that large matter, that essential matter, the good fellowship, the kindliness, the magnanimity, and generosity that prompted their utterance. Well, many things have happened since I sat here before, and now that I think of it, the President's reference to the debts which were left by the bankrupt firm of Charles 50. Webster and Company gives me an opportunity to say a word which I very much wish to say, not for myself, but for 95 men and women whom I shall always hold in high esteem and in pleasant remembrance, the creditors of that firm. They treated me well. They treated me handsomely. There were 96 of them, and by not a finger's weight did 95 of them add to the burden of that time for me. 95 out of the 96, they didn't indicate by any word or sign that they were anxious about their money. They treated me well, and I shall not forget it. I could not forget it if I wanted to. Many of them said, "Don't you worry, don't you hurry." That's what they said. Why, if I could have that kind of creditors always, and that experience, I would recognize it as a personal loss to be out of debt. I owe those 95 creditors a debt of homage, and I pay it now in such measure as one may pay so fine a debt in mere words. Yes, they said that very thing. I was not personally acquainted with 10 of them, and yet they said, "Don't you worry, and don't you hurry." I know that phrase by heart, and if all the other music should perish out of the world, it would still sing to me. I appreciate that. I am glad to say this word. People say so much about me, and they forget those creditors. They were handsomer than I was, or Tom Reed. Oh, you have been doing many things in this time that I have been absent. You have done lots of things, some that are well worth remembering too. Now, we have fought a righteous war, since I have gone, and that is rare in history. A righteous war is so rare, that it is almost unknown in history, but by the grace of that war we set Cuba free, and we joined her to those three or four nations that exist on this earth, and we started out to set those poor Filipinos free too, and why that most righteous purpose of ours has apparently miscarried, I suppose I never shall know. But we have made a most creditable record in China in these days. Our sound and level-headed administration has made a most creditable record over there, and there are some of the powers that cannot say that by any means. The Yellow Terror is threatening this world today. It is looming vast and ominous on that distant horizon. I do not know what is going to be the result of that Yellow Terror, but our government has had no hand in evoking it, and let's be happy in that and proud of it. We have nursed free silver, we watched by its cradle, we have done the best we could to raise that child, but those pestiferous Republicans have, well, they keep giving it the measles every chance they get, and we never shall raise that child. Well, that's no matter, there's plenty of other things to do, and we must think of something else. Well, we have tried a president 4 years, criticized him and found fault with him the whole time, and turned around a day or two ago with votes enough to spare to elect another. Oh, consistency! Consistency! Thy name, I don't know what thy name is, Thompson will do, any name will do, but you see there is the fact, there is the consistency. Then we have tried for governor an illustrious rough rider, and we liked him so much in that great office, that now we have made him vice president, not in order that that office shall give him distinction, but that he may confer distinction upon that office. And it's needed, too, it's needed. And now, for a while anyway, we shall not be stammering and embarrassed when a stranger asks us, what is the name of the vice president? This one is known. This one is pretty well known, pretty widely known, and in some quarters favorably. I am not accustomed to dealing in these fulsome compliments, and I am probably overdoing it a little, but well, my old affectionate admiration for Governor Roosevelt has probably betrayed me into the complimentary excess. But I know him, and you know him, and if you give him rope enough, I mean if, oh yes, he will justify that compliment. Leave it just as it is. And now we have put in his place Mr. Otto, another rough rider, I suppose. All the fat things go to that profession now. Why, I could have been a rough rider myself, if I had known that this political Klondike was going to open up, and I would have been a rough rider if I could have gone to war on an automobile, but not on a horse. No, I know the horse too well. I have known the horse in war and in peace, and there is no place where a horse is comfortable. The horse has too many caprices, and he is too much given to initiative. He invents too many new ideas. No, I don't want anything to do with a horse. And then we have taken Chauncey Depew out of a useful and active life, and made him a senator, embalmed him, corked him up. And I am not grieving. That man has said many a true thing about me in his time, and I always said something would happen to him. Look at that, pointing to Mr. Depew, gilded mummy. He has made my life a sorrow to me at many a banquet on both sides of the ocean, and now he has got it. Perish the hand that pulls that cork. All these things have happened, all these things have come to pass, while I have been away, and it just shows how little a mugwump can be missed in a cold, unfeeling world, even when he is the last one that is left a grand old party all by himself. And there is another thing that has happened, perhaps the most imposing event of them all. The institution called the Daughters of the Crown, the Daughters of the Royal Crown, has established itself and gone into business. Now, there's an American idea for you. There's an idea born of God knows what kind of specialized insanity, but not softening of the brain. You cannot soften a thing that doesn't exist, the Daughters of the Royal Crown. Nobody eligible but American descendants of Charles II. Dear me, how the fancy product of that old harem still holds out. Well, I am truly glad to foregather with you again, and partake of the bread and salt of this hospitable house once more. 7 years ago, when I was your guest here, when I was old and despondent, you gave me the grip and the word that lift a man up and make him glad to be alive. And now I come back from my exile young again, fresh and alive, and ready to begin life once more, and your welcome puts the finishing touch upon my restored youth, and makes it real to me, and not a gracious dream that must vanish with the morning. I thank you. An undelivered speech. The steamship St. Paul was to have been launched from Cramp's shipyard in Philadelphia on March 25, 1895. After the launching, a luncheon was to have been given, at which Mr. Clemens was to make a speech. Just before the final word was given, a reporter asked Mr. Clemens for a copy of his speech, to be delivered at the luncheon. To facilitate the work of the reporter, he loaned him a typewritten copy of the speech. It happened, however, that when the blocks were knocked away, the big ship refused to budge, and no amount of labor could move her an inch. As he had stuck fast upon the ways. As a result, the launching was postponed for a week or two, but in the meantime Mr. Clemens had gone to Europe. Years after, a reporter called on Mr. Clemens and submitted the manuscript of the speech, which was as follows. Day after tomorrow I sail for England in a ship of this line, the Paris. It will be my 14th crossing in 3 years and a half. Therefore, my presence here, as you see, is quite natural, quite commercial. I am interested in ships. They interest me more now than hotels do. When the new ship is launched, I feel a desire to go and see if she will be good quarters for me to live in, particularly if she belongs to this line, for it is by this line that I have done most of my ferrying. People wonder why I go so much. Well, I go partly for my health, partly to familiarize myself with the road. I have gone over the same road so many times now that I know all the whales that belong along the route, and latterly it is an embarrassment to me to meet them, for they do not look glad to see me, but annoyed, and they seem to say, "Colon, here is this old derelict again." Earlier in life this would have pained me and made me ashamed, but I am older now, and when I am behaving myself and doing right, I do not care for a whale's opinion about me. When we are young we generally estimate an opinion by the size of the person that holds it, but later we find that that is an uncertain rule, for we realize that there are times when a hornet's opinion disturbs us more than an emperor's. I do not mean that I care nothing at all for a whale's opinion, for that would be going to too great a length. Of course, it is better to have the good opinion of a whale than his disapproval. But my position is that, if you cannot have a whale's good opinion, except at some sacrifice of principle or personal dignity, it is better to try to live without it. That is my idea about whales. Yes, I have gone over that same route so often that I know my way without a compass, just by the waves. I know all the large waves, and a good many of the small ones. Also the sunsets. I know every sunset, and where it belongs just by its color. Necessarily, then, I do not make the passage now for scenery. That is all gone by. What I prize most is safety, and in the second place swift transit and handiness. These are best furnished by the American line, whose watertight compartments have no passage through them, no doors to be left open, and consequently no way for water to get from one of them to another in time of collision. If you nullify the peril which collisions threaten you with, you nullify the only very serious peril which attends voyages in the great liners of our day, and makes voyaging safer than staying at home. When the Paris was half torn to pieces some years ago, enough of the Atlantic ebbed and flowed through one end of her, during her long agony, to sink the fleets of the world, if distributed among them. But she floated in perfect safety, and no life was lost. In time of collision the Rock of Gibraltar is not safer than the Paris, and other great ships of this line. This seems to be the only great line in the world that takes a passenger from metropolis to metropolis without the intervention of tugs and barges or bridges, takes him through without breaking bulk, so to speak. On the English side he lands at a dock. On the dock a special train is waiting. In an hour and three quarters he is in London. Nothing could be handier. If your journey were from a sand pit on our side to a lighthouse on the other, you could make it quicker by other lines, but that is not the case. The journey is from the city of New York to the city of London, and no line can do that journey quicker than this one, nor anywhere near as conveniently and handily. And when the passenger lands on our side, he lands on the American side of the river, not in the provinces. As a very learned man said on the last voyage, he is head quartermaster of the New York Land Garboard Streak of the Middle Watch. When we land a passenger on the American side, there's nothing betwixt him and his hotel but hell and the hackman. I am glad, with you and the nation, to welcome the new ship. She is another pride, another consolation, for a great country whose mighty fleets have all vanished, and which has almost forgotten what it is to fly its flag to sea. I am not sure as to which St. Paul she is named for. Some think it is the one that is on the upper Mississippi, but the head quartermaster told me it was the one that killed Goliath. But it is not important. No matter which it is, let us give her hearty welcome and Godspeed. 67th birthday at the Metropolitan Club, New York, November 28, 1902, address at a dinner given in honor of Mr. Clemens by Colonel Harvey, president of Harper & Brothers. I think I ought to be allowed to talk as long as I want to, for the reason that I have canceled all my winter's engagements of every kind, for good and sufficient reasons, and am making no new engagements for this winter, and, therefore, this is the only chance I shall have to disembowel my skull for a year, close the mouth in that portrait for a year. I want to offer thanks and homage to the chairman for this innovation which he has introduced here, which is an improvement, as I consider it, on the old-fashioned style of conducting occasions like this. That was bad, that was a bad arrangement. Under that old custom the chairman got up and made a speech. He introduced the prisoner at the bar and covered him all over with compliments. Nothing but compliments, not a thing but compliments, never a slur, and sat down and left that man to get up and talk without a text. You cannot talk on compliments, that is not a text. No modest person, and I was born one, can talk on compliments. A man gets up and is filled to the eyes with happy emotions, but his tongue is tied. He has nothing to say. He is in the condition of Dr. Rice's friend who came home drunk and explained it to his wife, and his wife said to him, John, when you have drunk all the whiskey you want, you ought to ask for sarsaparilla. He said, yes, but when I have drunk all the whiskey I want I can't say sarsaparilla. And so I think it is much better to leave a man unmolested until the testimony and pleadings are all in. Otherwise he is dumb, he is at the sarsaparilla stage. Before I get to the higgledy-piggledy point, as Mr. Howell suggested I do, I want to thank you, gentlemen, for this very high honor you are doing me, and I am quite competent to estimate it at its value. I see around me captains of all the illustrious industries, most distinguished men. There are more than 50 here, and I believe I know 39 of them well. I could probably borrow money from the others, anyway. It is a proud thing to me, indeed, to see such a distinguished company gather here on such an occasion as this, when there is no foreign prince, to be feted when you have come here not to do honor to hereditary privilege and ancient lineage, but to do reverence to mere moral excellence and elemental veracity and, dear me, how old it seems to make me. I look around me, and I see three or four persons I have known, so many years. I have known Mr. Secretary Hay, John Hay, as the nation and the rest of his friends love to call him. I have known John Hay and Tom Reed, and the Reverend Twitchell close upon 36 years. Close upon 36 years I have known those venerable men. I have known Mr. Howells nearly 34 years, and I knew Chauncey Depew before he could walk straight, and before he learned to tell the truth. 27 years ago, I heard him make the most noble and eloquent and beautiful speech that has ever fallen from even his capable lips. Tom Reed said that my principal defect was inaccuracy of statement. Well, suppose that is true. What's the use of telling the truth all the time? I never tell the truth about Tom Reed, but that is his defect, truth. He speaks the truth always. Tom Reed has a good heart, and he has a good intellect, but he hasn't any judgment. Why, when Tom Reed was invited to lecture to the Ladies' Society for the Procreation or Procrastination, or something, of morals, I don't know what it was, advancement, I suppose, of pure morals, he had the immortal indiscretion to begin by saying that some of us can't be optimists, but by judiciously utilizing the opportunities that Providence puts in our way we can all be bigamists. You perceive his limitations. Anything he has in his mind he states, if he thinks it is true. Well, that was true, but that was no place to say it, so they fired him out. A lot of accounts have been settled here tonight for me. I have held grudges against some of these people, but they have all been wiped out by the very handsome compliments that have been paid me. Even Wayne McVie I have had a grudge against him many years. The first time I saw Wayne McVie was at a private dinner party at Charles A. Donna's, and when I got there he was clattering along, and I tried to get a word in here and there. But you know what Wayne McVie is when he is started, and I could not get in 5 words to his one or 1 word to his five. I struggled along and struggled along, and, well, I wanted to tell, and I was trying to tell a dream I had had the night before, and it was a remarkable dream, a dream worth people's while to listen to, a dream? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.